Well, once again, we want to welcome everybody to the examine class and also encourage you to look on the handout because you will notice that we also have a website, and Parker oftentimes mentions that. We put it up there just a minute ago, PrestonwoodExamine.org. The material that I will present today is available there. And for those of you that have a smartphone or a tablet, you can even go and watch that right now. Now, Pastor Graham, in the first service, obviously had a little bit of comment about Veterans Day. And we've never done this in the class before, but I'm just curious. Anybody here a veteran? Anybody here a veteran? Let's give them a round of applause. Turns out that I will be in Branson on that Wednesday because I'll be speaking at the Kennicott Institute. And if you've ever been up there, they really make a big deal about Veterans Day. So I thought we'd at least make a big deal about it today. And for those of you that are following my schedule, not that many of you probably care, I'm going to be leaving from here and speaking at Little Rock, Arkansas this evening. I have done this before at Fellowship Bible Church. And so they have last year had me speak on intelligent design. Tonight I'll be speaking on ISIS, Islam, and end times. And if it goes well, I might even do it in this class. But anyway, we've got a very large group that will be out there. And this is an event they do once a year and have me come in. So I'm looking forward to that as well. But if you would turn with me today, we're going to spend some time in the book of Hebrews at the beginning. But let me mention for those of you that are new to the class, one of the things we always do is try to then at the end either deal with an application or something that has been in the news. We had an election on Tuesday, and that election in Houston and an election in Kentucky all had to do with the issue of what? Homosexuality. And this week I had Al Mohler on my program, and so I thought I would take you through some of the material that we covered in his book. It was a great week, by the way. We had all sorts of people like Gary Bauer, as well as Louis Gohmert, and all sorts of speakers of different, Penny Nance of Concerned Women for America and others. But Al Mohler was one of those individuals, and I was so impressed with his book. I told him at the time that I already did a commentary. My commentary will air next week. And that I was also going to spend a little bit of time talking about that in the class today. So we're going to go through Hebrews, and we'll start, of course, at Hebrews 7, because what we oftentimes do is cover the material the church encourages us to do, and then I always like to give you some application points, and I think you will be learning both in the first half of the presentation, and especially in the second half of the presentation, all sorts of things maybe you did not know before. When we get to Hebrews 7, we are in Melchizedek. And that is this week, and next Sunday we will have covered chapter 7, and this is where we learn the most about him, but still a fairly enigmatic individual in the Old Testament. And here the theme, the overall theme of these first few chapters in the book of Hebrews is that Jesus is superior. So whether you're talking to an individual that is a Gentile or an individual that is a Jew, whether the individual is a Christian or a secular person, this particular book really, number one, helps you understand how Jesus is superior. And you really cannot understand the book of Hebrews without understanding the Old Testament. So again, we're going to see how he is superior, first of all, in terms of Melchizedek, in previous chapters, superior to the Old Testament law, and in terms of the priesthood. Let's look at the first three verses of chapter 7. For this, Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth of everything. He is first by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. Then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Okay, this is a pretty unusual individual, and this is used again to help us understand how Jesus is superior to the Levitical priest, because now the author once again takes us back to this priest known as Melchizedek. And it plays out this scene between Abraham and Melchizedek, which you can read in the Old Testament in Genesis. And of course, we can see that this is an attempt maybe also to answer a question that some of the Jews might have had, or even Jewish converts to Christianity might have. And that is, if you're a Jew, you know that the priest comes from which tribe? Levites, okay? And you can see that on the screen there. And so here you can see that the law said that from Abraham and now, especially from Moses to Levi, the Levites would be those who would be the high priest. You can see that the writer here of the book of Hebrews, could be Luke, might be Paul, is saying, no, this is Jesus who is our great high priest. And they're thinking, well, this doesn't work. And I gave you one verse there. You can look at the context a little bit later if you'd like, if you're taking some notes. Put down Numbers, verses 18, chapter 18, verse 6. Here it talks about the fact that I have taken your brothers, the Levites, and then it begins to describe their priestly service. So the question in everybody's mind is what we call cognitive dissonance. Somebody's saying one thing, but you're thinking something else. You're saying this doesn't fit. Maybe you've had this feeling when you've watched some of the presidential debates. They're saying this, but I don't really believe them, or I'm thinking something very differently. If you don't think that, listen to my program tomorrow. I've got Ed Klein, who has done the most extensive book on Hillary Clinton. We're going to spend a whole hour on Hillary Clinton. Ed Klein used to be with Time Magazine. It's going to be interesting, and you'll hear a little bit of that cognitive dissonance when we talk about that. But here, you have the same thing going through their minds. What is this? You know, Jesus can't be the high priest because Jesus is from the tribe of Judah. And so this is an important issue because now if he is indeed from the tribe of Judah, are we changing the priesthood? What is this all about? Because the tribe of Judah, of course, was not known for producing a priest. And so that's why now the writer focuses on Melchizedek. This individual in the Old Testament, we read very little about him in Genesis. But we do read a few things here. Number one, we know from the Old Testament that he was the king of Salem. Also, that he is described here as the priest of the Most High God. Well, that runs you into some problems because we know in the scriptures that it tells us that a man cannot look upon the Most High God. So how could you be a priest of the Most High God? Are you thinking that through for a minute? And so now it's beginning to suggest that maybe this is, on one sense it sounds like a man, but on the other sounds it sounds like something much more. It also says that Melchizedek is without mother, father, or genealogy. We see that right almost immediately here as we begin to read that in verse 3. And then it also says in verse 3 that he is without beginning or end, but resembling the Son of God. Got any possible candidates for that? Well, you can see why many Christians have believed that this could indeed be at least some kind of divine being, or more likely what many people have described as the pre-incarnate Christ. When you say, well, do we have any examples of the pre-incarnate Christ? Yes, we have a couple of those. Remember, of course, probably the simplest one would be going to the book of Daniel. Remember when they are to bow down before Nebuchadnezzar. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, we will not bow down. And they are thrown into the fiery furnace. Then they look into the furnace. There's three men in that furnace, but they see what? A fourth man. Okay? Of course, the wrestling with Jacob puts his joint out. Many people wonder if that might be. And there are times when there is a description of an individual in the Old Testament described as an angel of the Lord. So one possibility could be indeed that this is the pre-incarnate Christ. At the very least, it represents a type of Christ. Now, what do we mean by that? Again, I ought to give seminary credit for this, because in seminary we talk about typology, and a type of Christ would be an individual that is like a type of Christ. Joseph is that example, if you think about that. Many people said he's like a type of Christ. In other words, he gives you an indication of what it might be when the real Messiah comes. Daniel sometimes is identified as that. Doesn't mean they're Christ, but it just means that they have kind of a typology of sorts. So that's a possibility. But then you run into some real difficulties because it may not be the pre-incarnate Christ for a couple of reasons. First of all, he's described as a king of a local city, Salem, not as an angel of the Lord. Also is describing Christ as being of the order of Melchizedek, which seems to be talking about two individuals. I think probably more likely, though, we are dealing with the fact that Melchizedek and Christ are the same. And if they are, then that begins to put in all sorts of things, because remember what Abraham does. It says he apportioned a tenth part of everything. What do we call that tenth? The tithe. Pastor Graham just talked about this a minute ago. And again, during this season, he's asked all of us to really begin to tithe if we never have before, or to test the Lord in a biblical sense. And so we have talked about that as well. And so we see again this. So on the other hand, we have to address the claim that he is without mother or father or genealogy. He's without beginning or end. But certainly this was an attempt by the writer to help maybe answer a question that most of us do not have, but a Jewish believer certainly would have. And I would also suggest that this would be helpful if you have an Orthodox Jewish friend that you might know. Because sometimes that's a difficulty. If you spend time with Orthodox Jews today, and a lot of the Jews we run into here in Dallas are more Reformed or conservative Jews, but if you run into one that's Orthodox, they're all thinking, well, the Messiah has not come. Because the Messiah that I read about in the Old Testament doesn't fit Jesus. And one of those issues is, if indeed he is the Messiah, he comes from the tribe of Judah. Well, I think that's exactly what is described in the Old Testament, but some of them may have trouble with him being a high priest, or he is not the Messiah that we've come to expect. And so sometimes the book of Hebrews can be a very useful passage, as well as the Gospel of John, to help some of those individuals that have a Jewish background who have a real difficulty accepting Jesus as the Messiah. And every once in a while, I've had Jewish people on my radio program, and we get talking about, you know, really, you need to read the New Testament. And most of my Jewish friends will say, too new, you know, I want to stay on the Old Testament. Or they really have a difficulty. And it almost looks like spiritual blindness, doesn't it? And yet, in the book of Romans, it talks about the fact that the Jewish believers do not see the Messiah, but there will be a time. We see this in the book of Revelation, which we've gone through, in which they will once again recognize who the Messiah is. And so this might be helpful in that regard. But again, the Levitical priesthood, if you think about that, had everything to do with mother, father, and genealogy. If you were a Levitical priest, you had a distinct beginning, you were born, and you had a distinct end, you died. And so that's why so many people are saying that at the very least, when we're talking about Melchizedek, we're talking about this idea of an eternal priesthood, and that's, of course, exactly who Jesus is. He is our high priest, and he will live. There's no record or genealogy of Melchizedek. That's why he resembles and is like the Son of God. He's not only a priest, but he's also a king, and that brings those two parts together. Because Jesus is not just the Messiah, he's also the what? The priest, and he's also our king, King Jesus. And that brings all of those together. And so if nothing else, the meeting of Abraham with Melchizedek provides a historical precedent for this priesthood, and Jesus is our high priest. I thought it was interesting also, I saw some commentaries this week that expressed this, how often we do see Jesus in the Old Testament. As one commentator put it, he said, this meaning the writer of Hebrews, he likes to harvest Jesus fruit from Old Testament trees. I love that, you know. Every once in a while you come to an Old Testament tree and you pick off and there's Jesus. So for those of us that say, well, Jesus is only in the New Testament, here's just a reminder that we see Jesus sometimes in the Old Testament as well. He's in the New Testament and the Incarnation, but in his pre-incarnate form, we see him there as well. And that connects Jesus to this enigmatic king and priest, Melchizedek. Let's move on because we have a lot more to cover here. Verses 4 and following, we now get a little more understanding of this. Verse 4. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from the brothers, though these are also descended from Abraham. But this man, who does not have his descendant from them, received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. And so once again, we see the superior and the inferior. And here the author now begins to describe how Melchizedek is superior to the Levitical priest. And if you're taking some notes, I'm going to give you 3 points. 3 points, and then we'll conclude and move on to the next section. The first point is that Melchizedek is genealogically different from the Levitical priest. Why? Because the Levitical priests all go back to basically Abraham, or at least to Levi, and from that point on, Melchizedek was born or came into the world, whichever illustration you want to use, before that. So he stands as his own, as a priest and a king, and so he is distinct from the Levitical priests. So the point is, number one, if you hold that Levitical priest, the priests that were in the temple at that time, in high regard, Melchizedek is even higher. So that's the first one. The second is the blessing of Abraham by Melchizedek shows his superiority to Abraham. The point is that he actually gives a tithe. He gives 10%. And just think, if you were to give a tithe to a high priest, you are acknowledging that the high priest is greater than you. If you give a tithe to the Lord, we recognize that the Lord is greater than us. And that Abraham would receive a blessing from Melchizedek shows Abraham's willingness to humble himself, but also receive a blessing from his superior. So first of all, he ties to that, but he also receives a blessing. If somebody blesses you, oftentimes that person is superior. So in one other way, we see how once again, Melchizedek is superior to those Levitical priests. And that's very different. Matter of fact, you might put it in your notes if you want to look at it this week in your quiet time. Look at Genesis 14, because there's a point in which indeed there is a blessing given by Melchizedek earlier. But then when the king of Sodom, we all know about this, right, wanted to give a blessing to Abraham, Abraham what? Refuses it. So he receives the blessing from Melchizedek. He rejects the blessing from Sodom. We're going to talk more about Sodom in just a minute, but that's in a different context. Third, then the Levites, by association, tithe to Melchizedek. Now, this one's a little tough, but you can see this in verse 10. What the writer is suggesting is that they were in the loins of Abraham. Okay, that's kind of difficult to say. They were as the sperm and egg, if you will, of the future Levites. But the point is that because indeed these priests were in the loins of Abraham, they were other Jews, then in a sense, they by association also tithe to Melchizedek. It's an interesting argument made by the author, so I wouldn't necessarily say that's the strongest argument, but it's the one that we find in Scripture. So again, it's one more way to show that Melchizedek is superior to the Levi priests. The point of all of this, I thought, would be something that we've talked about here in the class for the last couple of months, and that is the importance of the tithe and all of the rest. And so it is interesting that when even the Scriptures give us wisdom literature about wisdom, they also tie it back to the tithe, which I thought was kind of interesting. Think about this. If you go to Proverbs 3, verses 5 to 6, this is a passage we quote so often. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. All your ways acknowledge Him and He will make straight your paths. We so often quote that passage and those two verses. But skip down just a couple of verses to verse 9, and what does it say? Honor the Lord with your wealth, with what? The first fruits of all of your produce. What were the first fruits? Well, that was the first part of the tithe. When the harvest came in, you gave the first part of that to what? Towards the temple. In the New Testament, the idea is when you bring in your paycheck, if you will, the implication is you give your first tithe, your first gift, back to the Lord. Does that make sense? But I thought it was interesting that it ties this idea of wisdom to the idea of giving. And so it was just as I happened to look up that verse, I said, wait a minute, that's kind of an interesting juxtaposition. In other words, a wise Christian not only depends upon the Lord and not on his or her own understanding, but a wise Christian also makes sure that he or she is giving to the Lord's work. Does that make sense? So just one more connection as we were talking about this tithe that Abraham gives to Melchizedek. So let's think this through. If Abraham tithed, if Jesus gave, if the disciples encourage us to give, what's the possible implication of that? I think you know where that's going. So again, I just wanted to cover this fairly quickly, and we will cover the rest on Melchizedek next week, but I just thought that because we went through some very interesting elections this week, it would perhaps be interesting to talk about this issue. And a lot of this is going to be taken from a new book by Dr. Al Mohler. For those of you that are not familiar, there was a vote this week, and matter of fact, many of us voted for, in some cases, 7 propositions. In some of your cities, you voted for 8 propositions, and they did very well. But in the city of Houston, they also voted for Proposition 1, which would, as many people called it, the bathroom bill. It was a transgender bill, and it went down to a resounding defeat in Houston, which actually is very heavily registered Democratic, not Republican, and had a mayor that was pushing it, and it went down to defeat. Likewise, we also saw a vote in the state of Kentucky. The governor there, who has been a supporter of Kim Davis, who was the individual, the city clerk, who had reservations about having her name on marriage certificates for same-sex marriage. Well, Governor-elect Brevin has now said he would support her. So we can see that this week, the issue of homosexuality was really kind of in the news. And so I thought it would be appropriate maybe to quote a little bit from the book by Al Mohler. It's available in your bookstore. Probably you can find it as well. Al Mohler is the president of Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. So when we had him on, we talked about some of this as well. And maybe to help you understand what he has been through, think about your first day on your new job. Can you think about that? I want to describe the first day on his new job. When he was brought into Southern Seminary, it had been a seminary which in the Southern Baptist Convention was really beginning to stray from biblical orthodoxy. And as a result, many of the students, many of the faculty did not endorse the Bible as being the inerrant word of God. So when he comes in as president, it was really controversial. How controversial, you might ask. Well, when he comes in to give the opening message in the chapel, at least half of the student body stood up and turned their back to him while he was giving his message at the chapel at Southern Seminary. Now, if that was not enough, after he finished there, he went to the president's office, and as he looked out the window of the president's office, he saw that he was being hung in effigy on the outside off of one of the trees outside of his office. That was the first day for Dr. Al Mohler at Southern Seminary right there in Louisville, Kentucky. But over the years, certainly he has done well. He was on CNN just the other night and has really been speaking to these issues. And so what I wanted to try to do is just briefly highlight just a few things from his book, because I learned some things, and maybe that would help you learn a little bit more about some of these issues. And the first point is, in some of his opening chapters, he talks a little bit about the fact that how did we get here? Well, it happened a long time ago, if you think about it, with the sexual revolution. In some respects, the homosexual revolution is just the natural follow-up of the sexual revolution. Because he argues that the sexual revolution in many ways turned the tables on Christianity. Because there was a time in which people saw the church, the evangelical church at the very least, as the guardian of what is right and righteous. Now today, oftentimes, individuals in the culture see Christians not as the caretakers of values, but on the wrong side of many moral issues. It isn't just that individuals have said, well, we've now accepted homosexuality or premarital sex or all sorts of aspects of the sexual revolution, but also anybody who disagrees with that, they're on the wrong side of history. And as a result, we no longer hold the high moral ground. If you're looking for some notes, you can certainly put down Isaiah 5, where it talks about a nation in the Old Testament, Israel, that called good evil, but also called evil good. And we have a situation now which those things which we used to say were good, we lampoon, we make fun of, chastity, abstinence, fidelity, and things of that nature. And then we have other things that we used to call evil, now we call those good, as an alternative lifestyle. And so he believes that a lot of that happened there as well. He quotes from one Harvard professor, and he has been somebody that's been talked about oftentimes at Prestonwood Christian Academy. I know when Michael Craven was there, and even to this day, some others talk about him. He was a professor who originally was born in Russia, was a professor at Harvard, Pitram Sorokin, who actually wrote a piece called The American Sex Revolution back in the 1950s. And he, as an individual that had grew up and actually saw the revolution of the Tsarist Russia to communism, he understood how revolutions took place and began to say, we in the 1950s, and especially happened in the 1960s, are in the midst of a major sexual revolution in America. Why did he say that? Well, there's a man who was at Indiana University by the name of Alfred Kinsey, and he began to publish results on the fact that he was saying that we need to change our views about sexuality. You have Masters and Johnson begin to study sexual relations. And most importantly, the individual that took this and ran with it, a man by the name of Hugh Hefner at Playboy magazine. And so as a result, began to even see in the 1950s the beginning of the sexual revolution. By the time we came into the 1960s, we saw a great deal more of that as well. He also talks about how we had, in different ways, redefined what sex inside of marriage was like. At first, it wasn't that controversial because they were talking about things like birth control and contraception. But even in the 1960s, generally, there was a belief that, you know, Christians had some questions about that in terms of how that might affect prenatal life and the rest. But once the pill became a reliable form of birth control, that in many ways actually opened the door for the sexual revolution. Now you could be sexually promiscuous, but not have to deal with the consequences of a pregnancy. And while that was happening in a cultural way, it was also happening in a legal way, because in 1965 there was a case called Griswold versus Connecticut. And this is where the writers of this particular opinion by the Supreme Court talked about the fact that we have a right to privacy. That 1965 led to, of course, 1973 of Roe versus Wade. But so you begin to see, first of all, we had a cultural as well as sort of a little bit of a legal shift in the area of birth control and contraception. Second of all, you also began to see the breakdown of the family. And again, I know some have been divorced. We're not trying to be critical of divorced people, but the point is that what he points out in the book is what was very rare at the time, almost inconceivable for most Christians, changed by the 1960s. And in a remarkably short period of time, the attitudes towards divorce changed. Consider this. In 1964, there was a real question whether or not Nelson Rockefeller, who almost became the Republican nominee for president, whether he could be the nominee because he had been divorced. By 1968, and certainly by 1976, a man who had been divorced, Ronald Reagan, it wasn't even an issue anybody discussed in terms of the political process. And so attitudes towards divorce began to change, and as a result, then laws began to change. You began to have, in the late 1960s, and especially during the 1970s, virtually by the time you got to 1980, virtually every state had no-fault divorce, which means you could be divorced for any reason or no reason at all. And so that changed the whole view of marriage. Then you had something else kind of intriguing, because during this time we also began to develop all sorts of advanced reproductive technologies, and that changed the view of marriage and family. Up until that time, if you wanted to have a baby, you needed what? A man and a woman, right? And you're going to see where this goes in terms of homosexuality in just a minute, but now you didn't necessarily need that. With the issue of birth control, you can now have sex without having babies, and now with reproductive technologies, you could have babies without sex. And so we completely divorced the idea of sex inside of marriage. Sex and procreation began to be very different kinds of things. Well, if you understand that as some of the precursors, then you just add one more. When people could get divorced, more and more people decided not to get married. The living together rate, the cohabitation rate in the 1960s was probably less than maybe 4 or 5% at best. And now very quickly you began to see that dramatically change, and more people began to live together. Whereas in the past you'd save sex until marriage, now it was considered old-fashioned and repressive. And we can see that right now, children born out of wedlock, 71% of children born out of wedlock to black women, 29% to white women, and those numbers are increasing over time. Well, you can see what that does to the issue and the institution of marriage. So in the midst of this comes what? The homosexual movement. How did the homosexual movement change from being a vice to a virtue? And a lot of this had to do with the fact that there was an attempt to not only have a sexual revolution, but also a cultural and moral revolution to change Americans' attitudes about homosexuality. And there was a gay agenda. And I want to talk about two books, neither of which I recommend for your quiet time, okay? But these are secular books that I think help you understand how they envisioned that change to take place and how successful they were. For those, some of you who've been in the class for a while, you may have heard me quote from this book. It's by Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen. They first wrote an article that appeared in Public Opinion and then turned it into a book. And they wrote this in the late 1980s. And their argument was simply this. We need more than just legal recognition. We need to change cultural attitudes about homosexuality. When somebody tells me there's not a gay agenda, I say, just read the book. And interestingly enough, both Al Mohler and I have read the book, and I can tell you what's in it. And they set forth a series of strategies by which to change not just the laws in America, but to change the cultural attitudes towards homosexuality in America. Now, they argued that at the time when they had the AIDS crisis, let's use that. They said, I know this sounds cynical, but if we can use the AIDS crisis, it makes homosexuals look like victims, and that's what they wanted to do. And they set forth a strategy. We want homosexuals to look like victims. We want to portray people who disagree with us as aggressors and as intolerant. We want to talk about homosexuality all the time. We want to work with journalists and film producers and television producers to have more and more things in which we'll have gay characters. We want to actually work through the legal process to get some kind of exceptions to domestic partnerships. We want to work with major corporations so that they will have domestic partnership benefits. And we want to do all we can to change the culture within at least a decade so that we can have homosexuality no longer look like a vice, but maybe even look like a virtue. I gave you the short list. How effective were they? Pretty effective, weren't they? And again, this was an attempt to pretty much bring about those changes. A second book that Al Mohler talks about as well is a book, again, a secular book, and it was an attempt to try to explain after the fact how homosexuals were able to beat back what she called the four horsemen of moral judgment. That is, that homosexuals are crazy, or that is, they need psychological treatment, that homosexuals are sinful, that homosexuals are criminal, and homosexuals are subversive. Now, I've not read the book, but I just, even getting a little bit into Al Mohler's book, began to think, okay, how did that take place? And if you'll permit me for just a minute, I want to take all four of those and show you how I think they took place. Crazy is the first one. How were they overcoming crazy? Well, it turns out that in 1974, the American Psychiatric Association met. There were all sorts of gay activists in the audience, and they began to protest the meeting and say that you need to remove homosexuality from your diagnostic and statistical manual. It used to be, and you can find an old one here, where homosexuality was listed as a treatable psychological disorder. And so because of that political pressure, not because there was new evidence, they no longer listed in the diagnostic and statistical manual homosexuality as a treatable disorder. So number one, they were able to overcome this idea that this is some type of psychological disorder, that these are individuals that are, if you will, crazy. And so that provided a step towards normalcy. Okay, how did they overcome the sinful part? Well, you've been in the class before, maybe hear how sometimes they reinterpret Genesis 19, Leviticus 18 and 20, Romans 1 and others. But the key to that wasn't so much working with the evangelical churches as it was working with the mainline churches. Because if you've paid any attention, you see how many of them have said, you know, the Bible really doesn't say anything about homosexuality. You know, we really need to encourage these individuals. We need to affirm people in their lifestyle. And so that's how they began, at least initially, to change that. And I would predict that unless things turn around pretty quickly, there may be more and more churches that will go along. How do they deal with the issue of criminal? Because up until that, you actually had certain laws on the books that said that individuals engaged in homosexual sodomy could be criminally punished. Now, the reality is that was rarely done, but I can point to two cases that really changed everything. One was a case out of Colorado in which they had actually passed a particular restriction on homosexual behavior. In that case, Romer versus Evans went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was Justice Kennedy, even back then, who ruled that this was unconstitutional. More recently, in 2003, he had a case known as Lawrence versus Texas, and that one went to the Supreme Court. Again, the court ruled that that particular law in the state of Texas, which had not really been used very much, is unconstitutional. And at the time, you had Antonin Scalia say that this decision will open the door for same-sex marriage. Months later, that's when the Massachusetts Supreme Court actually ruled that any law against marriage by two individuals, male or female, of the same sex was unconstitutional, and by 2004 we had the first same-sex marriage in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So the last one, how do they overcome the idea of being subversive, you know, that they're just not good for society? And I would recommend that there were a couple of television programs that have been able to do that. And to perhaps put that in context, think back to the last time you can remember on a television program where you had an intact family, a father and a mother, where both the father and the mother were rational individuals in control of their children, and where their children came to the parents when they had a problem. If you think about this, you're probably thinking The Cosby Show. Now, don't think Bill Cosby for a minute, but think Cliff Huxtable, okay? You know, that takes you in the wrong direction. I understand that. But think about Cliff and Claire Huxtable. When there was a problem in the family, Theo goes to what? Dad, Dr. Huxtable, right? Can you think of any since then? Let's go now to Will and Grace. When Grace had a problem, where did she go to? She went to Will, the homosexual character. Do you see the difference? And by the time you get to the modern family, you got an intact family, you got a divorced family, you got a homosexual family. It's, you know, you can see how very quickly, in a short amount of time, the culture changed. That's how we got there. What about this issue of same-sex marriage? Because that was also very key to the public and cultural acceptance of homosexuality. But this is where the homosexual movement had a real problem. Because within the homosexual movement, you got differences, but I'll just mention two. You have, first of all, what you might call the liberationist. Those are the ones that want to liberate homosexuality and all kinds of human sexuality. And if you've ever been to a gay pride parade, and growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, I can say that I have, you'd hear things like, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. You know, in your face kind of stuff. Well, those are not people that are really looking to get married, right? Because they think the institution of marriage is actually oppressive. So the homosexual movement had to sort of tamp that down. That was one of the attempts by Hunter Madsen, say, we don't need any more gay pride parades. We don't need angry activists out here because we won't achieve what we want, and that is public acceptance of homosexuality. And so the emphasis then went to move from the liberationist to the assimilationist. These were less confrontational people. Their phrase was, we're here and we're just like you. Matter of fact, if you go through the book, After the Ball, they have all sorts of suggested advertising. There are more homosexuals than there are golfers. There are more, you know, and all sorts of things that they were using to try to say, we're just like you. We're members of the Chamber of Commerce, and we worked at the Lions Club. And I even saw with my uncle. He worked with the Key Club, you know, and he was part of Kiwanis. And, you know, we're just all part of the natural establishment. We may be homosexual, but we're just like you. And so that was important to really emphasize that particular wing, if you will, of homosexuality, because then they could say, we're just like you. You can get married. Why can't we get married? It's a civil right. And so as a result, redefining marriage began to be the big issue because they recognized that most people define marriage according to nations' legal standards. If it's legal, it must be moral. And that's why activists have said, even in their literature, that they concluded that this legal victory, that is winning same-sex marriage, could accomplish 90% of their stated goals. They're working on the cultural side, but they also recognize how important the legal side was. And when five justices this summer decided that same-sex marriage was constitutional, they believe that that made a big difference. Now, although there is a shift, certainly in the position legally, I think we can now start seeing that there's been a stiff wind of resistance, haven't there? And what happened in some of these elections this week, I think, are an illustration of that. But even more than that, one of the arguments that you can make is natural law and even general revelation remind us what real marriage is. You know, even when you can say, well, I'll redefine marriage, for millennia, people in other cultures, not even Christian cultures, know what marriage is, right? I mean, you can't change basic biology, right? I mean, you recognize some of the basic plumbing, some of the basic reality of differences between male and female and all the rest. But nevertheless, that's the case. And I'd have to say that some of these recent cases, which have come down, like the Hobby Lobby case, and now some of these others are starting to come down as well, and these elections actually show some of the concerns that real people have about some of this. Well, what's the next battlefront according to the gay agenda? It's what we would call the transgender revolution. I like the quote that's in Al Mohler's book. He said, "Today's generation often encounters material that no previous generation could possibly have comprehended." You know, if I could go back in time and we could talk to you 30 years ago and tell you what happened today, would you believe any of it? I'm sure some of you would just, you know, some of you right now, even as I said that, are just shaking your heads. You can't even believe the conversations we're having. And now transgender is now considered the next kind of civil rights movement. But at its core is an attempt to actually redefine and eliminate ultimately the binary nature of gender. That there is just most male and female. And again, you say, how do we do this? Because we know where the biology is, and that's where this shift is taking place. The transgender movement would allow each person to determine their gender. It also includes the right, of course, to reform yourself or transform yourself or ruin yourself, depending on what you're thinking about, through what's called gender reassignment surgery. And I think, again, this just undermines the whole human identity that we have from a Christian point of view. Now, to show you where this might lead, let's look at Europe for just a minute, because oftentimes what happens in Europe eventually comes to our shores. And in Europe right now, there are countries in certain preschools that now prohibit the use of gender pronouns. You cannot say he or she. And they're even starting to come up with new pronouns so that it's gender neutral. Now, this has been attempted in Canada with limited success. It's been attempted in the United States with no success. But again, you can kind of see where that goes. But notice something very interesting. They use the word gender, not the word sex. Think about this. We used to call in the 60s the battle of the genders. No, we called it the battle of the sexes, right? Well, this is an attempt to say, well, okay, sex may be biological. This is what you are biologically, but gender could be anything that you want. And this is the wordplay that has to take place. If you move away from sex for a minute, let's look to the issue of abortion. And now, it used to be that people would say, an unborn baby is not human. But that's really difficult to do. I remember I was on a TV program in Washington, D.C. years ago. Cal Thomas and I were doing the TV program. And just before we went to the first break, this very liberal columnist who wrote for the USA Today said that a baby inside a mother's womb is not human. And Cal Thomas, in his way, said, as we're going to the break, what is it, a giraffe? Is it an elephant? Is it a rhinoceros? I mean, he's just going through this whole long list. I mean, it just humiliated her as we're going to the break. Because think about this. You cannot say that a baby inside the womb is not a human being. 46 chromosomes, you know, Homo sapiens. So after time, they began to say, well, it may be a human being, but it's not a person. And since the 14th Amendment only protects persons, it may be a human being, but it's not a person. You see how that played out. The same thing here. They recognize they can't deny the reality of sex. ACDC, you know, you recognize what you're dealing with, right? So they have to come up with something else, gender. And if you think that this has not made its way to the United States, go on your Facebook page and look at the genders you can pick. The last time I counted, there were over 50 different genders that you can pick for yourself. And again, some of you are just giving me the RCA Victor dog look. Remember Nipper the dog? Kind of like, can't believe any of this. And that is exactly the point. But again, natural law and God's word is still on our side. And I think this is where this battle is. A lot of people are starting to react. And certainly the reaction we saw in Houston, I think, is that. Let's come back to the obvious ones. How do we think about this biblically? Well, Genesis 1 tells that the human beings were created in the image of God. That's why I love the fact that we've got the Institute for Creation Research here. This battle over Genesis is key because that's where we find our foundations. Human beings are gendered and were given dominion. God created Adam and Eve, the binary system that we have here. Genesis 2 gives us even deeper insight into what it means to be human and what God intended for marriage. That a man and a woman would leave their families and cleave together in the bounds of matrimony, that's where you have a communication of love, of sexual intimacy, and children. And we've so schismed that, you know, we've removed the procreative parts and unitive aspects of sex. And that, of course, goes all the way back in some cases to what happened in the 1960s. Of course, Genesis 3 also explains why brokenness exists in the created order. You know, I've had individuals say, you know, I'm a homosexual and it just feels natural. Well, in a fallen world, yes, some really bizarre and decadent and depraved things can feel natural, but that doesn't mean that they are right. And in this fallen world, certainly biblical marriage, I think, is even more important as a defense against the effects of sin in the world. If we don't have biblical marriage, and anybody can have sex with anybody else, and nobody has a responsibility to raise any children, does that look like anarchy? In some respects, we needed marriage in the garden, but we need biblical marriage even more in this fallen world. And if you think it was important in the 19th century or the 20th century, it's going to be even more important for us in the 21st century. And most importantly, you can go to Ephesians 5 and even Ephesians 4, 5, and 6 if you want to look at that whole passage there and see that when God is explaining to us what the relationship between Jesus Christ and us as the church is, what does he use? He uses the picture of marriage. And so again, we can recognize how important that is. Well, if nothing else, I wanted to help you understand that we are entering into a time in which we're going to have to really rethink what it means to be a Christian in this world. And in one of his chapters, Al Mohler talks about something we've talked about in this class as well. You've got Christians asking whether they could even work in some occupations. You might say, well, I'd like to be a baker. Well, what do you do when a homosexual comes in and says, I want you to bake a cake for my wedding? Remember that situation? We've had a couple of them, one in Colorado, one in Gresham, Oregon. A florist, well, I'd like you to provide flowers for my wedding. Well, we have one in Richland, Washington that unfolded there. How about a photographer? I have one that was in New Mexico and others. And so that is the case. So we can recognize that there's a real question. I did a commentary this week on, of all things, who would think that you, as a person that makes t-shirts, would be in a problem? Well, turns out one in Kentucky, Gay Pride Parade came in. They said, we want a Gay Pride Parade t-shirt. And he said, sorry, I just can't do that. Now, I don't make t-shirts for Satanists or anybody else. So, I mean, it's not, I'm just against you. You know, somebody says, you know, I believe sex without marriage is right. I wouldn't make a t-shirt for that. Well, they brought him for charges. In this case, he won, though, because the judge realized, you know, we can't. As a matter of fact, it was interesting. Two other t-shirt companies in the state, which were run by homosexuals, came and defended him as well. Because they were saying, you know, we wouldn't want to make t-shirts for this group in Canada, Westboro Baptist Church, that are anti-gay. We wouldn't want to do those. And there are all sorts of things we turn down. So even though we're homosexuals, and even though we might disagree with him theologically, we defend his right to be able to say no. So we're kind of seeing some of that pushback. And of course, the Supreme Court has ruled that Hobby Lobby certainly is within its right to deal with some of these issues related to abortifacients. But of course, you know what the next one are going to be, homosexuality. And now the Supreme Court is considering other cases related to nonprofits. So we'll see where that is. But you know, when I had Kelly Shackelford on Friday, he was talking about how this next election is going to determine everything. Because look at that vote, 5-4. Think of the vote on the issue of what? Well, same-sex marriage, 5-4. The next president is going to determine which direction it goes. Right now, you actually have the Supreme Court ruling 5-4 that there's an individual right in the Second Amendment to own a firearm. But imagine if it goes the other way. We've had some 5-4s go one way and some 5-4s go the other way. Whoever the next president is will perhaps for a generation determine the direction of this court. And so it will be, I think, even more important to not only think about who he or she is, but also who he or she would appoint to that court and what that would mean for the future of this country. Well, there's a lot more we can say, but I always like to end at noon, and it is noon. But if you're interested, this book goes into a lot more detail. But I don't believe that we should be overly concerned. We actually see some very positive signs that some people are beginning to stand strong. But one of the arguments I've made in the past is it will probably be much more important for us to know what we believe and why we believe it in the 21st century. Because sometimes we're going to be challenged in ways that we weren't before. And in some ways that may be good because it's going to separate the wheat from the chaff. some individuals that said, oh, I'm a Christian, you know, because, hey, I go to church maybe once or twice a year. Yeah, that's they're not going to be standing so strong anymore, and so it'll be real easy to figure out who the Christians are and who the people that aren't Christians. And I think it's going to be a great opportunity for us to speak the truth and to speak it in love. And I think Al Mohler does a great job in his book. Parker?